Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Let's talk. John Brown. Ian Matthews, A People's History is an oral history of one of Britain's leading singer-songwriters. One of the founding members of folk rock pioneers Fairport Convention, Ian left the band in 69 to form a career in music that now spans almost 60 years. He's been there, he's done that, he's got the t-shirt, he's fretted the cord or whatever, and I'd like to say that Ian now joins me live on the line from his luxurious pad somewhere in the hills over Hollywood, you know, a margarita in one hand, a blonde in the other, and looking at the swimming pool. Ian, good morning to you.
Good morning. Not quite as glamorous as the hills of Hollywood. I'm actually in Brighton.
Well, that's London by sea, Ian. I mean, you can, you know, overlook. Are you Brighton or actually are you Hove actually?
I'm in Brighton.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, because that's the whole thing. Now, for those who don't, I mean, 60 years. You know, I mean, to paraphrase something that was once written, who knows where the time goes?
It's a lie. It's a lie. I started last week.
How did it all start, Ian? And what was your sort of, you know, who were your influences in music then to get you into this game?
Yeah, I started out. Well, at the time I was 15, 16 years old. I was an apprentice sign writer. And working indoors in a sign writing shop in Lincolnshire, and we had the radio on all day long. I was going to say Radio 1, but there was no Radio 1. It's just the BBC in 1964, 65.
Yeah.
And they played pop music most of the day. So my early influences were basically whatever was on the radio at that particular time. I mean, before that, I grew up listening to whatever my mother played, whatever she had, you know, and she was kind of a big Jim Reeves fan, and but she also used to listen to a lot of black gospel a cappella groups.
Right.
And so that was a pretty early influence on me as well.
So did you get the Burke Wielden songbook? I mean, when did you decide you wanted to pick up and have a thrash around? I mean, did you take lessons? I mean, did you listen to sort of American imports? I mean, how did you learn your style? How did you learn to play?
I learned to play through necessity, really. I'm not a great player. I'm a songwriter that needs to play the guitar to write songs, you know. I'm pretty basic at what I do. But I was living in a house. It was towards the tail end of my Fairport days. Yeah. I didn't play anything in Fairport. I just stood up and sang. But towards the end of it, I wanted to be a songwriter, and I was living in a house with Richard Thompson.
Yeah.
And he took me into the West End of London and picked out a guitar for me, and he said, okay. We went back to the house. He showed me three basic chords and sent me off and said, come back in a week and I'll show you some more.
Richard Thompson gives you a guitar and says, here's three chords. I mean, that's like Ayrton Senna saying, okay, well, let's just put it in first gear and see how we can drive it.
That's basically it. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you have to, it takes a week to figure out to get any sort of muscle memory going. And it takes 2-3 weeks to get any sort of calluses on your fingers. So that, you know, that first initial period, that first month, 6 weeks, it's just trying to figure out the positions, the chord positions. You know, there's no real playing in that first period. You know, it's all.
So how did sort of Fairport come around? I mean, because you talk about, you know, listening to pop music, and your mum was listening to, which is incredibly progressive, listening to sort of like gospel a cappella. But you know, you would have thought might have become sort of, I don't know, the new Dave D, Beaky McIntitch. How did nothing wrong with them, and I know Beaky very well. So what? Became, I mean, how did Fairport come around? And was it in parallel to what was happening with the folk scene over in Greenwich Village? I mean, do you know about, is it a particularly English twist on this? I mean, how, because you've got, you know, bands like this, bands like Family. I mean, how did that whole English folk tradition come around then?
Well, you know, contrary to folklore, I wasn't actually a founder member of Fairport. They already existed when I joined the band.
Yeah.
They had a female singer. They were big fans of what was happening out on the coast in California and the New York singer-songwriter scene. They were very hip about that stuff. And I would say, to a small degree, when I joined the band, they were influenced by that stuff. It accelerated as we moved along. We also had a manager, producer, a man named Joe Boyd, who used to be part of the committee on the Newport Folk Festival. Ooh, so,
right.
Yeah, so his influence was pretty heavy on the band as well. And we just kind of, once we had that male-female vocal thing going, we just sort of modeled ourselves on some kind of generic sound that was happening. We played a lot of cover songs. Nobody was really writing in the beginning. We'd sneak a few originals into the set, but for the most part, you know, we were doing Dylan and Leonard Cohen and Joni and Richard Farina and stuff like that. Just kind of finding our way like any other band, not knowing whether it was going to be done in a year or whether it was a lasting thing.
And when you're doing something like that and taking it, you know, to an audience, you know, at festivals in the UK, for example, what's their reaction like? Because, some people, you have the possibility that people wouldn't get what you're trying to do, and they just go, oh, they're trying to sound like Laurel Canyon. They're in Laurel Canyon, and in fact, they're, you know, they're close to Avon as a sort of thing.
I think a lot of people did believe we were an American band. I mean, we had that sort of casual, semi-hippie approach to being on stage. You know, we didn't really present ourselves to any great degree. We just sort of got up there and played the music. And, you know, we had a song, we would do a Richard Farina song called Reno, Nevada, which had quite a long guitar solo in the middle, and Judy, the other singer, would go off to the side of the stage and sit on the stage and knit.
Knit?
Knit.
Right. I mean, not knit some sort. That's not sort of... I mean, you can't see Stevie Nicks in the middle of Fleetwood Mac going to the back of the stage halfway through and thinking, hand me the needles, I mean, or whatever. I mean, she was...
Well, that's what I'm saying, you know. There was no real presentation. I mean, Stevie had a presentation. We didn't have a presentation. We were just there about the music. We just wanted to let people in on the secrets of unknown singer-songwriters.
What was the scene like then? Because, I mean, bands are having to go on tour now because of the streaming services mean that you can't get the money from albums that you would before, because people used to go, kids asked their parents, used to go out and buy stuff. And so now touring is, you know, I mean, A, it's got an awful lot more expensive for normal people, and I class myself like that very, very roughly, to go and see a band, because it's all coming in at 150, 100 for and festivals are very, very expensive, and people want a show because they paid that much. What was the, and it's all very corporate. What was the scene like when you were, you know, those early days when you're doing festivals, you're doing gigs? I mean, was there a lot of sort of interplay between the bands?
Musically, no, but there were only a certain number of bands that you knew you were going to encounter on the road. Maybe 30 bands in that that were on the same kind of circuit as we were. And it was a real kind of mix and match period. You never knew. There wasn't all that pre-advertising. The festivals did it, of course, but university gigs never did any pre-advertising. So you'd turn up at a university, let's say University of Essex, which we played several times as Fairport. We would turn up at a gig at the University of Essex to find that there are three bands on the bill. The whole thing probably kicked off at 10 o'clock at night and ended in the early morning. Three bands on the bill. Opening act was, headliner was Family.
Yeah.
You remember Family?
Yeah.
We were the middle act, and the opening act was this new band from Sheffield called Joe Cocker and the Grease Band. Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing happened all the time. We did a lot of gigs with the original Fleetwood Mac. We did a lot of gigs with Yes, Pink Floyd. And because of Joe's influence, we do a lot of shows opening for touring American acts. You know, particularly the folk acts, Leonard Cohen and Joni. I remember once we opened for Moby Grape.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was a real no holds barred kind of scene at that time. Everybody was exploring. Everybody was on the road to find out what was there and what they liked. And
it must be really difficult though, opening for a Joni Mitchell or a Leonard Cohen, because people have come to see those two sort of, you know, not at the same time, but do you know what I mean? I mean, they are, you know, it's great to be on the same bill as an opening act, but you get like 20 minutes, 30 minutes tops, because they don't want, you know, because otherwise the audience, I mean, not saying that Leonard Cohen start, you know, doing what they did at Monsters Rock and starting throwing bottles of you know what at you, but it's still, is it great fun, but at the same time, you know, you've only got a certain time.
Well, yeah, I mean, there wasn't that kind of limitation on opening acts back in those days. Right. You know, everybody got a fair shot at it. I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure that we got a 45 or 50 minute set. And most of these shows that we would play with the touring acts were at like places like the Queen Elizabeth Hall and stuff like that. So, you know, we didn't play clubs or universities with the touring acts. And festivals, of course, we play festivals with them too. We played the very first Isle of Wight festival with the Jefferson Airplane. And,
ooh, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, we played at 5 o'clock in the morning. I remember we used to do this Leonard Cohen song called Suzanne.
Yep.
And I remember I used to sing with my eyes closed a lot, and we did a long version of Suzanne, a 10 or 11 minute version. I remember closing my eyes to start to sing the song, and I opened them at the end of the song, and when I closed my eyes it was dark, when I opened my eyes it was daylight.
What was the, because you decided to get your own way. I mean, did you just want to write more? I mean, because Fairport, when, I mean, I used to love, because I'm a sort of a rock fan, a heavy rock fan, and they used to do these great family trees of you know, who was playing with what, and Richie Blackmore was here, and there was a bass player from there,
from
Tull to Uriah Heep. I mean, Fairport also, there was quite a bit of emotion, wasn't there, within Fairport, you know, singers.
There was.
Yeah.
At a certain point, there was a lot of branching off and doing other things. That was after I'd left the band, yeah. You know, I left the band. They had that awful road accident where people died. And at that point, things began to fracture a little bit. And Ashley, the bass player, went off and started Steel Eye Span. And then Sandy went off and started Fotheringay. And that, so it was late 68, early 69 before any of that stuff really happened. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff came out of that initial Fairport convention.
So when you go off on your own like this, how did you find it easy? Was it a sense of relief because you could go off and write your own stuff? Because you said, one of your songs, I think, but you called it "I Survived the 70s" or something along those lines. So, I mean, did you find that people, because you can try and do your own path, or you can try and be trendy and popular. I mean,
it's never easy starting something new because you have to. There's always that initiation period where people either take to it or they don't take to it. It was easier back then because it was a less crowded playing field.
Right.
So people were far more open to new and different things. You know, when I started Matthew's Southern Comfort, it was a whole different sound to what anybody else was doing on the kind of circuit that we were on. Nobody was using a pedal steel guitar. So initially, there was a curiosity factor took hold, and ultimately people embraced it. But I got lucky. It could have easily gone the other way and nobody was interested. And then what? Then you either give up or you find a different direction to go in.
Yeah, during that 70s period, of course, I mean, that's you go down so that, you know, you get the Eagles, Neil Young, all that sort of sound, which you're doing sort of with Matthew's Southern Comfort, but with a twist, aren't you? Because now, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Copperhead Road, all that sort of, and the way that sort of what country music has been embraced by that style of music has been embraced by the mainstream in a way that wouldn't have been 40 years ago.
I was trying to meld folk music and country music. You know, I was trying to bring a singer-songwriter / folk music tunes to a more country sound.
Yeah.
It was a real hybrid that I was doing, and I think that was that added to the curiosity factor as well. I don't know. You never know why people embrace things and why they don't. I believe in destiny. You know, there's a certain point that you're in at a certain time, and when those things align and people are in line with it, it happens. And if it doesn't align, tough shit.
Yeah, I mean, but you could. Well, that should be a T-shirt. But I'm just thinking, because you could say that, you know, I mean, folk music is poor man's protest singing, you know, and the blues is you know, the poor black man's experience, and country is the poor man's white experience. So the whole thing sort of goes in a circle, and it all points, you know, they're not distinct genres. There's some crossover, isn't there?
Yeah, it's all music. It's all music. It's all personal taste. It's all experimentation. And it's all stepping stones, you know. I mean, whatever I've done throughout my career has been a stepping stone to the next thing. You just try stuff. Well, not everybody does it that way. You know, some people find a groove and they stay in that groove and that's what they do. Love it or leave it. I've never believed that. I've always kind of found something that I like, something that I thought I could do. I try it, I do it, I'm happy with it, and I move on and try and find something else that I can do.
You know, in the sort of the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, when, you know, all of us a certain age started getting into our 50s and whatever, and you had the reunions and the getting togethers and the whole thing and reinventing it. Clapton comes back in and, you know, Plant and Page come back together. Did you find that a difficult period? I mean, did you think, well, I've never really gone away, to be honest with you, chaps?
I just did my own thing, you know. I looked at what was going on. Wasn't particularly the 80s was a typical period for me. I just wasn't that interested in very much during the 80s. And I just did my own thing, carved my own furrow and hope that I would still have an audience at the end of it, you know, when the next century came in. And here I am. You know, here I am. I'm still doing it. I'm still enjoying it. I still feel creative. I'm still learning. I still fortunately have my voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is there an end in sight? Probably, but... I can't find it yet.
What's it like when you go out there then and you see people? I mean, what's the connection? Because I always talk about connection when you play live, because that's the most important thing between an artist and the audience. If you can't connect to an audience, you've lost them and they're gone. I mean, Yeah.
I talk to my audience. You know, I treat them like old friends. There's no barrier there. There's no me and them. It's all about us. And I just try and draw them in, and it usually works. I try and get them to talk to me. I don't want to sit there in silence. I want some kind of communication. So I try and get an audience to talk to me. And
when you look back now, are you still in contact with Richard, for example, from that period? Do you sort of stand there and go, I can't believe we're still kind of here, still standing sort of situation?
Yeah. Yeah, I live in the Netherlands these days, and I'm doing I live in a small town in the south, and I'm having an 80th birthday concert bash next year.
80th? But luckily through Clean Living and Regular Prey, you don't look a day over 25, Ian.
I'll be 80 in June, yeah. And I'm having a birthday bash, and Richard is coming to play at that. So, in the local town hall.
No, that's absolutely superb. The book. Decided to put it all down for memory, so people know what we're. It's called A People's History.
Yeah.
Why A People's History, Ian?
Well, because I didn't write a damn thing. It's all the company that does these books. That's what they do. They get fans to write in about their experience with a particular act or the particular act's music.
Yeah.
And then they have them send a picture with it. Maybe they'll have a photo of them posing with the act, or maybe they took a snap during a concert or something like that. And they get a couple of hundred people to write a little piece, and then they publish it. So I didn't contribute a thing to this book. It's a book about me.
The thing is, this thing strikes me. That could be, you know, because they could say, oh yeah, I met Ian. It was the most wonderful moment of life. It transformed me. And you were like, well, it was somewhere in the Low Countries in the mid 70s. I haven't got a bleeding clue. That could be a bit embarrassing,
yeah,
isn't it?
And you get negative shit too. You know, it's not all positive, but that's what it's all about. You take the negative with the positive.
A thought just struck me, and this is very rare, Ian, and the listeners will be going, yeah, he hasn't had a thought since 1985. But the thing is, when you write a song, okay, it means something to you, okay? It means something to you because you write it from a personal experience, or you need to make a point.
Yeah.
But the audience or an individual could take that song in a completely other way, couldn't they? I mean, they
could.
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the song. You know, that's the beauty of songwriting. You can write a song that you think relates completely to your experience, but then if you present it to an audience and they will relate to it however they want to relate to it. And a lot of times, you know, you're writing somebody else's story as well. You're not just writing your own. I kind of write in a universal way. I don't get precious about that kind of stuff. And I write so that people can embrace a lyric and make it their own as well.
Do you sort of get up in the morning and go to write some this morning, as you know, somewhere in the Low Countries, looking over, I don't know, a dam or a windmill, and go, you know, today I shall write the song of our time, or, you know, and you write between 7 in the morning and 10, I'm going to write a masterpiece. Or does the muse just sneak up behind you and hit you with a baseball bat and go, there you are, Ian, there's a lyric?
No, I don't write that way. I wait for inspiration to hit. Every other day, when I'm at home, I go out in the morning and I walk for an hour or an hour and a half. And a lot of my songwriting happens while I'm out walking in the mornings. Sometimes I get an idea for a song title, or sometimes I get an idea for the beginning of a verse or a chorus. But a lot of my lyric writing, I co-write a lot these days too.
Yeah.
I have a good friend who lives about 10 miles up the road from me, and I farm a lot of my lyrics out to him, and he writes the music to them.
Do you take a dictaphone, or do you call it on your device? Because, I mean, the number of times people, you know, think that's going to be a great idea, that's a great riff, or a great, and then you get back and you think, oh, what the hell was that? I mean, do you carry something that you can sort of go dump into?
I just take my phone with me.
Yeah.
And if I get an idea, I stop and put it in my notes and stuff like that.
Fabulous. If people want to find out more information, do you do social media? Do you do a web? I mean, where can people find where you're playing?
A lot of Facebook. Ian Matthews Music on Facebook. I have a website. Again, it's ianmatthews.nl. So it's a Dutch website.
Wonderful.
I don't go there a lot, to the website. It's more my Facebook interaction with people.
Well, listen, it's been wonderful. Thank you for spending the time to talk to us this morning. The book, which Ian, people talking about Ian, is called Ian Matthews, The People History, and you can order that via our own virtual bookstore. But go to ianmatthews.nl and you can find, or go to his websites, yeah?
All right, mate. That's perfect.
Ian Matthews, yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Likewise. Thank you for doing it.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.